Greetings and salutations. So today I'm going to discuss the subject which is listed here, a decade of precision electroweak interactions. Actually, can the lights be dimmed? Okay. Ah, thank you. Okay. So the traditional role of particle physics has been to understand those interactions in nature which are not visible except at the microscopic level. And there may be more, but there are two such interactions which are very well known: the strong interactions, which mediate the nuclear forces, and the weak interactions, which mediate radioactive decay processes. And of those, the weak interaction was for a long time the most mysterious. But over the past, 20 to 40 years, all the basic ingredients were built up, leading to a coherent theory of the weak interactions, which I'm going to describe to you. What I'd mainly like to do in this talk, though, is to talk about the experimental basis for this theory, which has really dramatically improved just in the last 10 years, with a number of new experiments, which I'll tell you about. So the plan of this talk will be basically to give you a quick overview of what this theory of weak interactions looks like, focus in on some very definite predictions of it, and then explain to you how these predictions have, in the past 10 years, really been dramatically confirmed experimentally. So I just remind you of the basic ingredients of the theory of weak interactions: parity violation, the so-called V minus A, the statement that weak interactions couple to 1 minus gamma 5 in the usual parlance of relativistic field theory; the fact that the weak interactions are mediated by charged particles called a W boson and by neutral particles called a Z boson; and then eventually the discovery of neutral currents at Fermilab and at CERN in the early 70s, leading to finally something which particle physicists give the boring name of the standard model, a model proposed originally by Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam, and I guess this past year, or rather the year before, the achievements of Tolf, Veltman, and Ben Lee were celebrated in terms of really teaching us how to compute with precision in this model. So let me describe the model briefly, and then we'll focus in on some predictions which one can then try and access experimentally. The model is a gauge theory. That is to say, it's built on a fundamental symmetry under which some particles are rotated into others. The symmetry is SU2 cross U1, the rotation group cross the group of rotations on a circle. Each generator of the symmetry leads to a vector particle that mediates some interactions in the theory. So SU2 leads to three particles, W plus, W minus, and W0, with a coupling constant called G. The extra U1, which has the structure of just Maxwell's equations, leads to another vector particle whose coupling is G prime. The second aspect of the theory is spontaneous symmetry breaking. The fact that even though the theory treats, let's say, these three particles here in a completely symmetrical fashion, the solution of the theory, the lowest energy state that we see in nature, is asymmetrical among those particles. Something everywhere in space sits down and picks some direction that causes this one to be preferred with respect to these two. What the mechanism of that is still really pretty much a mystery. And we'll come back to this at the end of the talk. But if you accept the fact that this SU2 rotational symmetry is broken, that the charged W's and the neutral W actually have different orientation with respect to the symmetry, then everything else will naturally follow. The charged W's become massive, and here's a formula for their mass in terms of the symmetry breaking condensate. The neutral particles actually mix. One of them is massless, and that thing has exactly the quantum numbers and properties and couplings of the photon, and so we can identify this particle with the carrier of electromagnetism. And then there's left over a heavier particle, just slightly heavier than the W boson. So those are two of the major ingredients of the standard model of weak interactions. And the third one is parity violation, which is now readily expressed by the statement W plus, W minus, and W zero couple only to left-handed quarks and leptons. And so out of that, we will try and build some kind of complete theory of weak interactions. We need one more slide full of equations to really narrow down to what we're going to try to measure. So I'd like to say a little more about the mixing of W zero and B zero. Here are the linear combinations that have definite mass, the photon and the Z boson. This defines a mixing angle called theta W. Actually, theta W is given in terms of the ratio of the two fundamental coupling constants in the theory. Very often, what we'll try to measure is the square of the sine of theta W, which is given by this relation. And conversely, a measurement of this parameter gives you the ratio of these couplings, and with one other piece of information I'll tell you in a moment, gives you their precise values. The photon couples to a piece that has to do with W0, and Y is the charge to which B0 couples. This whole thing is the electric charge, which I'll call Q. The charge of the electron, E, is given in terms of the fundamental couplings by this formula. And so a measurement of E, or alpha, and a measurement of sine squared theta W then allows you to extract the two fundamental couplings in this theory. Alpha is extremely well known, so to the extent that we can measure this with high precision, we can find really the fundamental coupling constants of this theory. And the Z boson couples to the linear combination that I have written here, so it can be thought to couple to this charge. And that charge can be re-expressed factoring out, that charge can be re-expressed in the following way. As T3, the third component of isospin of this SU2 that I had referred to before, the parameter sine squared theta W, and the electric charge. T3 has the following interesting property. It's zero for right-handed particles, because as I said, the W0 only couples to left-handed particles. And for the left-handed particles, it's plus or minus a half, depending upon whether it's the upper or the lower component of some SU2 multiplets. So for most of the talk, I'm going to focus on this formula. This formula has actually a very wide range of values, depending upon which quark or lepton species I'm talking about, what the electric charge of that species is, what the handedness of the species is. And so the main thing that I'd like to discuss in the talk is how one systematically measures this parameter for all of the possible values that it takes as you go over the spectrum of fermions that we see in nature. Now, why has our knowledge of this subject advanced recently? Well, in 1989, two new accelerators were commissioned, the LEP synchrotron at CERN and the Stanford Linear Collider at SLAC, basically exactly to address this question. The Z boson is a heavy particle that decays, among other things, to electron-positron pairs. And that means that if you can create beams of electrons and positrons which can annihilate, they'll annihilate into the Z as a resonance. It's a dramatic resonance. It increases the cross-section for electron and positron annihilation by a factor of about 1,000. And so just at that resonance energy, you can make literally millions of these Z particles, observe their decays, and measure their couplings with tremendous precision. And so what I'm going to do is then describe to you what's come out of this program. Maybe I should mention that at the same time, the CDF experiment at Fermilab began a program of precise measurement of MW, which has recently borne fruit both with CDF and with D0, the other Tevatron Collider experiment. And they also, at the same time, showed that the top quark is very heavy. In fact, that the top quark, the heaviest quark, is actually heavier than the W boson. And this piece of the story will also come in, as you'll see, at the very end of the lecture. So these four things happening at once in the summer of 1989 began really a new era in the study of the weak interactions. an era of precision electroweak experiments. I should say that very early in that era, there was a program on this at the ITP. In fact, Howard Haber and I organized a mini program in, I think, January of 1991 here at the ITP, where theorists came from all over the world and debated the fine points of how you do sub 1% theoretical calculations in the weak interactions. Well, for this talk, I'm just going to assume that that can be done. You all know how hard it is to do these calculations, but we're all theorists. We just assume we can do that. And then now the problem is, what do the experiments do? So let's talk about what did these experiments measure and what did we learn from them. Well, before I discuss this in detail, I'd just like to show you one very impressive qualitative slide. This slide is interesting because it comes from the summer of 1989. It was actually shown by Guido Altarelli in his summary of the status of electroweak interactions at the Lepton-Photon Conference, the big international particle physics conference that year. You see here the measurement of, this is now sine squared theta W, and for various reasons, things are converted to a parameterization where the top quark mass, which the top quark, of course, wasn't discovered until 5 or 6 years later. The unknown top quark mass is on this axis. This error bar here was the new measurement of the W mass that had come just that summer from CDF and from the UA2 experiment at CERN. This region here was an analysis done by Ellis and Foley of the low-energy neutrino data, which gave some constraints on the weak interactions. And this band here was the brand new measurement of the Z mass from the SLC. And you can see that there's some rough region of overlap, which represented our knowledge of the parameters of the weak interactions as of the summer of 1989. In the summer of 1999, I redid this compilation, and it turned out that where we had gotten to was this little purple dot here. So in terms of precision, at least, we've learned a lot. And now let's go on and try and explore this. Oh, excuse me. Now, there is one more caveat that I should make before we talk about the experiments. Lepton SLC did not discover any new particles, and basically the result of this experiment was that the theory of Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam was confirmed in tremendous detail. And there are many people in the particle physics community who found this very disappointing. For example, already at the 1990 International Conference, Friedrich Didak showed this cartoon. I happen not to agree with this view of particle physics, and I hope that by the end of this talk you will agree with me rather than with the sympathy presented here. Now, the last thing in the introduction. I'd like to clarify one very important conceptual issue that has to do with what exactly it is that we're measuring. One might think, I've mentioned a couple times in this talk, and it will become now a major theme when we turn to the experiments, that the weak interactions couple dominantly to left-handed spinning species. So I'd like to explain to you precisely what I mean by that. Handedness of an ordinary particle is not a Lorentz invariant concept. And so you might well wonder why I'm making laws of nature that depend on handedness. The fact that handedness is not Lorentz invariant is very easy to see. I take a ball, I set it spinning in the, right-handed direction. I then start, in a somewhat uncharacteristic way, running very fast in that direction toward the wall. Eventually, if I run fast enough and maybe don't hit the wall in time, I'll see the ball at rest, but still spinning in the same direction. And then eventually I'll see it in my own frame reversed, but still spinning like that. So you can see that for an ordinary physical object, a right-handed particle and a left-handed particle are related by a Lorentz transformation. So this can't be what I mean by handedness. And what I mean is something a little more sophisticated, which is shown on the next slide. If you actually look into the structure of the Poincaré group, what you find is that actually the basic representations of the Poincaré group are classified by handedness. why that can be true is that implicitly on the last slide, I assumed that that ball was massive, that I could catch up to it, that I could consider it to stop in some frame of reference. If it were massless, it would be going at the speed of light, and I could never make it stop and reverse its helicity. And in fact, the most basic representations of the Poincaré group are massless, either left spinning or right spinning representations. A particle with some definite spin orientation, which here I've taken to be left-handed, taken by CPT into the antiparticle, which has the reverse spin orientation. And so what we would really like to do is to use these representations to build up the theory of the weak interactions. And what the weak interactions do is exactly that. They take, if you like, only the left-handed particles and not the right-handed particles, and insist that those particles have definite coupling. So this then is why we're so interested in these interactions. They somehow couple to the fundamental pieces out of which we make quarks and leptons before we complicate the story by generating masses for those particles. And in fact, in the Glashow-Weinberg-Sawa model, the quark and lepton masses, like the W mass, come from spontaneous symmetry breaking. So there's some formula where all of the fermion masses are connected to some unknown parameters, and then V, the vacuum expectation value of the symmetry breaking or Higgs field. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is to consider tests of the properties of the Z boson. And so what I'd like to do is look back a couple slides where I wrote for you this formula, that the Z charge is computable from the quantum numbers of things as the weak interaction isospin, the electric charge, and the value of this parameter sine squared theta W. And what I've done here is just to list the values of that quantity for all the various known physical species: neutrinos, electrons, quarks of charge 2/3, and quarks of charge minus 1/3. Here for the left-handed component, here for the right-handed component. Now, in the column called SF, I put the sums of the squares, and I've evaluated this at the value sine squared theta W equals 0.231, which I will defend on the next slide. And in the far right-hand column, I've put the asymmetry, that is the preponderance of left-handed versus right-handed, as the square of the charges. So roughly, this thing is the probability that the Z will decay into this particular particle. And what's over here is the asymmetry, that is, what is the preponderance of left-handed versus right-handed particles that come out in that decay. And so here we have a whole table of numbers. And in principle, each individual number in this table can be checked experimentally. So now I'd like to show you how to do that. And let me just point out that if you do that, and if the whole pattern is consistent, we will then learn the value of sine squared theta W extremely precisely. So let me put this table over here. And we'll refer to it often as we go through this analysis. First of all, we need to get a value of sine squared theta W in order to figure out where we stand on this table. And the most accurate way to do that is to measure the Z mass. Now, the Z mass is the energy at which we have the big resonance in E plus E minus collisions. And so if you understand your accelerator very well, so that you know what the integral bending field is around the accelerator, then you can actually determine this mass to high precision. This is done at the LEP accelerator in Geneva, which I remind you is a 30 kilometer circumference synchrotron. So really understanding its properties precisely is very delicate. You can do it, if you like, to first order by looking at the electron spin precession for polarized electrons that go around the machine. The corrections to the value you get have a lot of, if you like, standard corrections about how magnetic fields change with the current in the accelerator. But actually, there are some really exotic effects that you have to take into account to get the precision here, essentially five-digit accuracy. You have to worry about the fact that the tides change actually the size of the LEP ring. You have to worry about the fact that as the seasons pass and the water level in Lake Geneva rises and falls, the ring slightly changes in configuration. To get this to the MeV level, you actually have to worry about the electric current generated by trains that pass the CERN site. And the story of how they found that out is quite an interesting one, which we can address later if you wish. In any case, sorry? Well, there is a complete time-dependent model of the size of LEP, which is verified in, if you like, complete detail to 5 significant figure accuracy. So there, I think it's correct to say that at the MeV level in the mass, there are no glitches in that time dependence which are not understood. It's very impressive, actually. Well, you measure the temperature everywhere in the ring. You have, as I say, this first order measurement from the spin precession. Maybe 20 or 30 man years of effort has been put into modeling the exact shape of the LEP ring. In any case, the result that comes out is this amazing number. It's really a new precision constant which goes into the textbooks. And that can be the basis then for comparison with other ways that you can determine the parameters of weak interactions. So just to sort of get a first foothold, if you take the simplest equations of the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam model, you can relate this number to sine squared theta w in this way. You take the value of alpha, the value of the Fermi constant, the strength of low energy weak interactions, and the mass of the Z. If you just plug that in, you get this value 0.231, which leads to the predictions on this slide. And then we can ask, yes, the Fermi constant's actually known beyond 5 significant figures from mu decay. Yeah, you can't get it that accurately from beta decay. But mu decay has been studied quite precisely. Okay, so now let's start talking about how these parameters here are measured. And first of all, let's talk about the column SF, which has to do with the probability that the Z decays into different quark and lepton species. So here's the formula for the total width of the Z resonance. It involves alpha and MZ, which, as I've said, we know very precisely. Sine squared theta W, which is to be determined, but for which I've given you a value that you can plug into this. Then the squares of the charges, which are written on this slide. And then there's a factor called NF, which at first sight we have to take into account because quarks come in 3 colors. So you have to multiply by 3. That's the quantum number that the strong interactions couple to. But then because quarks, as they come out of the Z, can radiate gluons, there's actually a correction, which is about 3%. And since the measurement we'll talk about is considerably better than 3% accuracy, this correction is essential. Actually, when the smoke clears, this is going to turn out to be one of the best ways of measuring the strong interaction coupling constant alpha S. The final number that you find from experiment is this. It's in very good agreement with the value of sine squared theta W that I just showed you. But I'd like to show you one more aspect of this experiment. As the electron and positron go in and collide and annihilate to make the Z, they can radiate photons before they annihilate. That radiation changes the line shape of the Z. This is a well-known effect in atomic physics, but here it becomes a really qualitatively large effect. The photon radiation causes the Z resonance to be moved to slightly higher energy and also changes the shape of the Z resonance, causing it to slough over like that. And so actually, this measurement contains all 3 of the fundamental interactions of nature, the weak, the strong, and the electromagnetic, to get it right and to make the measurement to that accuracy. So now let me show you what the experimental results are. Yes? I'm sorry? No, the mass and the width uncertainty in MeV are about the same. But the mass uncertainty is the overall... I'm sorry?
What
Oh, no. Yes. Okay. So here's the data on the line shape. Well, this is from one of the four left experiments. Tony here in the front row can see that there are actually error bars on those red points. The asymmetry of the peak is the quantum electrodynamic effect that I just described to you. Actually, the final LEP analysis of the line shape just came out, and I'll show you that figure. This curve here is the zeroth order. The green curve is with the QED correction. These are the composite of the four LEP experiments. The error bars are expanded by a factor of 10 so you can see them. And and the parameter gamma z is defined by the full width half maximum of the zeroth order curve, which I've shown here. So all in all, really a quite remarkable agreement of theory and experiment.
I guess what Steve was asking was the width of this curve is huge compared to the uncertainty you have in the
back. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. So the curve is 1,000 times larger than the uncertainty in the mass. And you couldn't get the mass unless you understood the curve theoretically with high precision. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You mentioned there was an atomic analog system, but the final method? Isn't there explaining the non-resonant channel and scattering and resonant
channel? Oh, no. It is the initial state interaction, the distortion of the curve by initial state interactions. I'm not sure what the correct name of it is. Please excuse me. Okay. Well, now we know how to get this, if you like, the sum of the squares of the S's. So now how do we get the S's individually? Well, to do that, what you have to do is to separate the observed Z decays into one of these four classes here. Well, actually, only these three classes can be observed, but if you have the total width, you can infer how much is coming from the unobserved neutrinos. So basically, we have to image each of these Z decays and then count them and separate them. For this, you need a large sample of Zs. LEP, actually, between the four experiments, accumulated 17 million Z decays. SLD, the detector at SLAC, about 500,000. And the polarized electrons I will come back to a little later. My friends are at SLAC, so I have many pictures from there. But these things look quite similar if you look and see what was done in the LEP experiments. What you need to image these events is some large piece of scientific apparatus. This one is called the SLD detector. It's about three stories high. It includes various devices as you go outward from the collision, which takes place in here, to first of all image tracks. Then there's a calorimeter, which then measures the amount of electromagnetic radiation, photon energy, deposited. A magnet, which you'll use to measure momentum. And then eventually a hadron calorimeter, which will catch the neutral hadrons that come out and measure their energy. Just for interest, here's a picture of this detector under construction. There's a little cart that you see down here and a person. So you get some idea of the scale of what you have to build in order to do these experiments. And let me just show you one typical event picture. I'll show you a lot more of these as we go on. This is a very beautiful Baba scattering event, E plus E minus to E plus E minus. You see the stiff track from an E plus E minus pair going back to back. Lots of energy in the electromagnetic calorimeter because the electrons produce electromagnetic showers. And so this is very clearly identified as something that goes in the electron column here. And now what we have to do is to divide up all of the ZDKs into appropriate columns. So Olive has produced a very nice figure that I can show you here, which shows that these events are, in fact, very characteristic and, by and large, easy to separate from one another. This, with lots of pions coming out, is a decay to quarks. This is what I just showed you, a decay to E plus E minus. This is a decay to mu plus mu minus, where you have a very stiff and so-called minimum ionizing track. And this kind of event, where you have low mass, maybe different numbers of tracks on the two sides, is a decay to the heavy lepton called tau. And so in that way, one can sort events into various of the categories which are indicated here. So I hope you can imagine now that the numbers in this column can be measured. But now we come to the really tricky part, which is to measure the numbers in this column. To measure the numbers in that column, you have to not only know which way the particle, what kind of particle it is and which way it's going, you have to know how the particle is spinning. And so how can we get that out experimentally? Well, I'm going to show you three methods. Let's start with the leptons, and then later I'll show you how this generalizes to quarks. The first method is just to look at the angular distribution. And so here's a little argument about the angular distribution. Let's say we started with a left-handed spinning electron. When that annihilates, it annihilates on its antiparticle in the fundamental sense that I discussed before, so a right-handed spinning positron. Those particles then turn into a Z, which is at rest in the lab with the spin orientation that I've indicated. The Z now might decay to muons, which are also spin a half particles, and they have definite spin. But you can see that if the muons go off with the muon in the forward direction and the anti-muon in the backward direction, and if the muon is basically spinning in the left-handed sense, then this process is very easily allowed by angular momentum. But you can see that if that muon went backwards, it would be disallowed by angular momentum. So pushing that through, you come to the conclusion that you have these characteristic angular distributions. 1 plus cosine theta squared for a left-handed electron turning into a left-handed muon eventually, and 1 minus cosine theta squared, just the opposite, if the muon came out in the right-handed sense. So my claim is then that by studying the angular distributions, either the forward-backward asymmetry of particles that come out of the Z, or what comes out of the Z if you put polarized electrons in, then you can actually have access to the couplings which are shown in this, the last column of this table. For future reference, I'd like you to remember that the average of these two distributions is 1 plus cosine squared theta. So if I didn't know anything about the polarization information, if it was all equal, or if I couldn't tell a particle from an antiparticle, the distribution I would expect would be 1 plus cosine squared theta. And we'll see that distribution again in a few slides. Okay, so just as a first test of this, here's some data from SLAC which used a polarized electron beam. According to the prediction here, there should be a 15% excess of left-handed versus right-handed particles coming out of the Z. So what that says is that if I put in left-handed electrons, I should see a slightly forward peak distribution. If I put in right-handed electrons and look at leptons coming out, I should see a slightly backward peak distribution. And indeed, that's exactly what's seen. Forward peaking for the left-handed beam, backward peaking for the right-handed beam. Also in mu's and tau's. Now this is an okay way to measure sine squared theta W. But there are a couple much better ways. One of them is to use the fact that the heavy lepton, the tau, decays in a way in which it can analyze its own polarization. The tau is a very heavy particle, so when it decays, the spins of everything that it decays to are very characteristically displayed. And here's an example. Let's say we have a left-handed tau lepton, which is moving very rapidly in this direction. One of the things that tau can decay into is a pion and a neutrino. A neutrino is always left-handed, and a pion is a spinless particle. So if I look at the way the spins are oriented, the decay which is most allowed by angular momentum conservation has the left-handed neutrino going forward and the pion going backward. If I boost this, if the tau is relativistic, it says that the neutrino is fast and the pion is slow. You can replay this exercise where the tau has other decays, for example, to an electron and two neutrinos, or to a muon and two neutrinos. And what you find is that the left-handed tau has characteristically a faster electron, a faster muon, and as I've just shown you here, a slower pion, whereas the right-handed tau has the opposite, a slow electron, a slow muon, and a fast pion. So now what you'd like to do is to accumulate some fraction of a million zeta tau decays, plot the energy spectrum of the pions, electrons, and muons that come out, and fit it to some model that has to do with the tau polarization. Just for your curiosity, here's a typical zeta tau event. So you see there's a one prong over here, which in this case, I guess, is an electron, but in other cases might be a muon or a pion. And over here, you see a decay of the tau with low mass to five pions, which really cleanly nails that this event is a tau. So now let's look at these distributions. Well, here's the data. This is already from quite early in the left run, and the situation has improved, but already on this slide, you can see that it's a quite dramatic effect. So the bottom panel here is the one that I described to you in detail. This is the energy spectrum of pions from tau decay. You can fit this by a superposition of left-handed and right-handed taus, the left-handed given by the red distribution, the right-handed by the green distribution. You can see that there really is a noticeable slope, which is not an instrumental effect. It is a 15% preponderance of this one over that one. And by measuring that difference, then you get a measurement of sine squared theta w by measuring the tau polarization coming out of the Z. If you look at the electrons and muons, again, the red is the left-handed tau, the green is the right-handed tau, and you can see that there really are more left-handed taus coming out, giving you a consistent determination of sine squared theta w. Well, finally, there's another method you can use, which is actually a very simple one, except, of course, to actually technically realize it. That is to make separately polarized left-handed and right-handed electron beams, run them into a beams of unpolarized positrons, make the Zs, and see if, indeed, the electron beam, which is left-handed, makes 15% more Zs. To actually do this, you need to have an accelerator which preserves the electron polarization. So it has to be a linear collider. You can't use a synchrotron. And you need a source of highly polarized relativistic electrons. Here's actually a diagram of what's used at SLAC. You have some lasers up here which produce linearly polarized light. You then have something called a Pockel cell, which when you apply an electric field to it, acts like a quarter wave plate and circularly polarizes the light. If you put a random time series of impulses on it, you'll get light which is circularly polarized in a known but randomly changing orientation. You then use that light on a gallium arsenide, actually a strained gallium arsenide cathode, to produce an electron beam, which then dominantly has the circular polarization of the photon that went in. And then 3 miles that way, you look for a change in the cross section for making Zs. So in that way, obviously, many experimental systematic errors cancel out, and you can make a very accurate measurement. And in fact, here's the measurement of sine squared theta w and of AE, the last number in that column that comes from this experiment. Okay, well now I've explained to you in gory detail how to measure this number. But these two numbers, maybe you might say, are a little harder to get at for several reasons. One is that it is not clear how to figure out which way a quark spin is pointing. Quarks, of course, are not seen in isolation. They're only seen as constituents of hadrons. In the Z decays, there even aren't many protons. Most of the things that come out are pi mesons and K mesons. And so you have to be able to take that information and go back and infer the spin orientation of the original quark, which gave birth to this configuration of strongly interacting particles. And secondly, it's not so obvious how to tell up-type quarks from down-type quarks. So whereas we'd like to measure these two parameters here separately, we need some trick to be able to do it. So let me discuss those things in detail. First of all, how do we measure the quark spin? Well, from what I told you earlier, we can measure the quark spin by measuring the forward-backward asymmetry for events where E plus E minus goes to a quark-antiquark pair. So there, what we really need to do is to infer the quark direction. Of course, we don't see the quark direction. What we see are the directions for some large number of pions and kaons that come out of the event. But if you look and see what these events look like, well, here's a typical one. They look like this. Here's another one. This is something that is very familiar to David, who worked hard on this, I don't know, 20 years ago. What happens is that the events have a very obvious axis when you just look at them, along this way. And if you look at them in terms of the momentum flow, that axis is even more obvious. There's a very large momentum parallel to that axis and relatively small transverse momentum perpendicular to it. The explanation for this is that when the Z gives rise to a quark and antiquark, they come roaring out in some direction. The quark and antiquark then pull extra quark-antiquark pairs out of the vacuum and eventually absorb them, and everything reorganizes into neutral states, pions and kaons, which contain one quark and one antiquark. However, those interactions are relatively soft. They don't involve large momentum transfers. And so if you look at the event, that original axis, which was laid down by the quark and antiquark, is still very obvious. In fact, if you histogram what the axes are in these events, here's what you get. And amazingly, it is a beautiful 1 plus cosine squared theta angular distribution, exactly what you would have predicted by thinking of these events as quarks rather than thinking of them as pions and kaons. Well, in the interest of full disclosure, every once in a while you do see an event that looks like this. And the interpretation of these events is that the thing which is radiated over here is the gluon, the quantum of the strong interactions. From the rate of these events relative to the two jet events, you can get another way of measuring the strong interaction coupling constant, which actually agrees at about the 3% level with the other way I've already told you. You can measure that parameter. Okay. Well, now we have to distinguish these species to figure out what is the up quark and what is the down quark. And to do that, we can use the fact that some particular species, including in particular the heavier quarks and leptons, have definite measurable lifetimes. So for example, the tau meson, which the tau lepton, which I told you about, has a lifetime of a third of a picosecond, which as far as elementary particle physicists are concerned is an enormous time and leads to a really enormous distance c tau, which is almost a tenth of a millimeter. Now, you have to admit that it is something of a technological challenge inside a piece of experimental apparatus which is three stories high to measure a decay length of a tenth of a millimeter. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. And so in SLD, and there are similar devices inside the LEP experiments, what you use is something that looks like this. So this is a can. It's about this big, a cylinder. Each layer you see here is a CCD. The pixel size of the CCD is 20 microns square. A charged particle exiting through that plane will leave ionization in one pixel, and then you can very precisely image the track that that particle took going outward. Let's see. Here I have another one of these tau events. So you all recognize that that's z decay to tau plus tau minus. Now we can look at that event up close. I should have put it on the other transparency projector. The x there is the very well-determined point where the electrons and positrons are actually coming in and annihilating. And you can see that a finite distance away, there's the point where the three tracks originate from. So one can actually make these measurements very precisely. Sorry? That's right. So again, let me show you one of these QQ bar events. This happens to be an E plus E minus to BB bar event. And when you look at it up close, you can see that there's a vertex here and a different vertex here that some of the tracks are originating from. So in this way, one can very cleanly identify these events that have to do with heavy quarks, separate them out, and know whether, in this case, it is a B, an up or a down type species. There's one more trick you can use to clean this up a little. Vertices with large C tau should also have large mass. So you can look, please excuse me. You can look at the tracks which visibly are associated with this vertex, add up their momentum four vectors, and compute the mass. When you do that, you get a distribution that looks like this. And then the colors are the SLD experimentalists' model of what it should be. The bottom quarks, which have typically a larger lifetime, also populate this region of large mass. And so if you were to put a cut, for example, here, you would end up with a very pure sample of ZDKs specifically to BB bar. The yellow region here has to do with charm quarks, which have a slightly shorter lifetime. And so in that region, you would get a reasonable sample of charm quarks. So in principle, then, you could separately measure the ZA symmetries for bottom and for charm quarks.
Hey, what is that line that goes off?
Oh, that's some mismeasured track. Okay, so presumably it's excluded. It might be a cosmic ray. It might be just some random hits that came from some background from the accelerator. You don't know, and you always have to deal with that. Okay, well, now I see that I made a mistake because that great table that I had has disappeared into this pile. Let's see if I can. Here it is. Okay, so now let's look at what that A sub F column was for the charm quark and the bottom quark. You can see that whereas this number here was 15%, for the bottom quark, because a third is a small number and its square is even smaller, this number is enormously larger than the square of that number. So the asymmetry is almost maximal. And for the charm quark, it's also extremely large. And so for these heavy quarks, when we look at their production from polarized electrons, we should see not just some little puny asymmetry. We should see a big order one asymmetry, where the left-handed electron produces quarks that go forward, the right-handed electron produces quarks that go backward. There's a difficulty in doing this because you have to tell which is the quark and which is the antiquark. The bottom quark, for example, is negatively charged, so it tends to produce more often a negatively charged pion forward or a kaon forward or a negatively charged muon forward or something like that. So the reason these results don't look perfect is because there's some difficulty in figuring out which is the particle and which is the antiparticle. But in principle, there ought to be quite a dramatic effect that from the left-handed electrons, we have a forward peak distribution. Right-handed electrons to left-handed Bs, a backward peak distribution, a large asymmetry, and so we should see a dramatic effect. And here's the data. So selecting for Bs, there really is quite a remarkable effect in terms of the angular distribution. The upper slide with left-handed polarization, the bottom slide with right-handed polarization. The histogram is the experimentalist's estimate of the smoothing of this distribution because of the confusion between particles and antiparticles. And by the way, if you do the same measurement with charm, it's not quite so impressive. This is left-handed on this side, right-handed on this side. But again, you see that there's a very dramatic effect. Okay. Well, now I haven't yet quoted the numbers that come out of these analyses, but I think maybe it suffices to put here a whole table of these numbers. This is the most recent compilation of the LEP Electroweak Working Group. So these are all of the various precision quantities in the weak interactions which have been measured over the past 10 years. In this column, what you see is a display of their disagreement with the simple Glashow-Weinberg-Salam model in terms of a number of standard deviations. So except with a couple counterexamples, for example this one, everything is in quite good agreement with some, you know, statistical fluctuations around a well-determined model. Some of the errors which you see on the slide, I won't keep it up here for very long, but you can consult it later, are really quite remarkable. Now, before we come to the interpretation of this, let me just tell you about one more of these contributions which has been seen very recently. The LEP accelerator recently increased its energy above to 200 GeV in the center of mass and above. And probably the main reason you've heard about this in the newspapers is the failure of the accelerator to discover the Higgs boson. But there's something else they've done which is really very beautiful. If you went to truly asymptotic energies, you ought to be able eventually to get to an energy where spontaneous symmetry breaking is irrelevant. An energy so high that, if you like, the symmetry which was broken in the W and Z masses is restored. If that were true, you would expect that the cross section for producing E plus E minus annihilation to fermions through photon and Z would instead be writable in a formula like this, where this is the contribution of the W0, and this is the contribution of the B, the underlying constituents before you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. So it's interesting to ask whether, at the energies we've gotten to, this formula actually works. Well, as I said, recently these cross sections have been measured up to 200 GeV, and in fact there are some very impressive results. Here is just the comparison with the Delphi experiment, which I haven't mentioned yet, of the cross section values with respect to the standard model prediction indicated by a straight line. But now what one can do, this is a data compilation due to Mike Hildreth, is to take the various asymmetries, the forward-backward asymmetries for leptons, charm, bottom. This is the fraction, the hadron to lepton ratio, and this is the fraction of the decays which are to bottom quarks. And to plot the data as a function of energy, and the arrow is the prediction of the formula that I wrote on the previous slide. So you can see that in all cases but this one, one is really now in a regime where spontaneous symmetry breaking is irrelevant, where we're seeing the symmetric weakened electromagnetic theory at the highest energies probed by accelerators. Here, too, this is the B fraction. The disagreement is not very large. There's a suppressed zero, so the zero is down here somewhere. The discrepancy here is accounted for by the fact that in radiative corrections, the bottom quark can turn into a top quark. And the top quark is so heavy that you're really not quite asymptotic at this point. But we'll get there. Come to my talk tomorrow. Okay. All in all, there are a large number of observables which are in agreement with the predictions of the standard model. And I should point out that the level of agreement, being considerably better than 1%, requires that the order alpha electroweak radiative corrections are taken into account. So these diagrams are all computed, and they are summed, and these diagrams are necessary to get the kind of agreement with the standard model which is shown in this slide. So, what have we learned? Well, I have two conclusions with one sign and one conclusion with the other sign. So let's start with this sign. First of all, I think we've learned very dramatically that quarks and leptons are real. I mean, in the press and even when we talk to one another, we sometimes think of quarks and leptons as some kind of hypothetical entities which theorists make up to explain experiments. In the 80s, we had, of course, Andrew Pickering saying that the neutral currents were a social construction. And I think that the level of agreement of experiment with the very detailed properties of quarks and leptons have really just completely exploded that point of view. we can take these particles, we can bend them, we can see which way they're spinning. We really understand their behavior as if they were billiard balls. And we know that these are the basic entities of matter that we have to confront. The second topic is that I think the nature of weak interactions is a solved problem. There are certainly corrections to this, and there's a lot that we don't know about the physics of sort of the underlying levels of particle physics, in particular what the spontaneous symmetry breaking is and how the masses of all these particles are generated. But given that, we have a theory which is tremendously predictive in terms of what it tells us about the behavior of quarks and leptons. And the third thing is that we have some clues to the nature of physics at the next level. And the reason for that is that the precision electroweak experiments don't just measure the quantum fluctuations of W bosons and Z bosons. They can, in principle, be sensitive to corrections to the Z and W structure from any kind of new physics that couples to the electroweak interactions. So in particular, we could imagine that there are vacuum polarization corrections where the Z goes into some new species of particle and antiparticle, and that should have an influence on the observables that we've seen here. Those new particles might be new heavy quarks and leptons, Higgs bosons, supersymmetric particles, some other kinds of exotic particles that theorists might have dreamed up. Amazingly, the new contributions that we might expect from these particles do not show up in these precision electroweak experiments. And they do not show up at a level that severely constrains the possibilities for including modifications of physics at the next level. Unless these contributions cancel by some more or less automatic means, these new theories are excluded. Let me just show you some examples of that. I have a favorite way of analyzing this by taking the vacuum polarization diagrams, the W and Z structure, parameterizing them with some kind of two-parameter fit. In principle, if those two parameters are generated consistently, one can then say, well, here's the structure of the W and Z vacuum polarization diagrams. And if the values turn out to be zero, there's no new physics. So once again, one of these very impressive slides. This is the fit to these two parameters from 1990. If you take this little box here and expand it out, this is the 1998 fit. And let me show you today's ST fit. It looks like this. Actually, there's one more thing I'd like to show you in this diagram. You see here there's a tiny little figure inside that box, which is actually the range of these parameters which you obtain by varying the top quark mass and the Higgs boson mass within the standard model. Here it grows to a somewhat larger figure. And on this figure, you can see it displayed very directly. So this is the prediction for the renormalization of the Z vacuum polarization due to the top quark mass along this axis and the Higgs boson effect along this axis. The central value here is the measured central value of the top quark mass with the error from Fermilab. And the Higgs masses assumed here are 100, 200, 300, 500, and 1,000 GeV. It's actually very impressive that very heavy Higgs bosons are excluded by the electroweak fit at its current level of precision, driving us away from models where the Higgs is some composite, where spontaneous symmetry breaking of the weak interactions is some analog of superconductivity, and toward models where this spontaneous symmetry breaking arises from a genuinely new fundamental field, which is put into the Lagrangian, the Higgs field. Many of you might have heard of models called Technicolor. Technicolor models, at least the simplest way of building them, gives you a point about here. So this is what I said, that one has derived very strong constraints on what kinds of modifications we can see of the standard model at small distances. Now, one of the models which is still in the running when you make precision determinations like this is the class of models called supersymmetry. And in fact, those of you in the audience who are particle physicists know that the light Higgs boson, even as light is indicated on the last slide, the heaviness of the top quark, and the small values of electroweak corrections were all actually a priori predictions of realistic phenomenological models, which included supersymmetry. So somehow that information very strongly drives you in the direction of this kind of a solution for physics at the next scale. There's another piece of evidence which is also very interesting. You remember I've told you that we've now with these experiments determined the values of the fundamental coupling constants, G and G prime, and also the strong interaction coupling constant, to quite high precision. And so now you can use the standard renormalization group equations that you would find in any quantum field theory textbook to try to extrapolate these coupling constants to very short distances and see what happens. In the standard model, I'm writing everything in terms of alpha. Alpha is g squared over 4 pi, and the renormalization group equations give a result which is for which alpha inverse is linear on a log scale. So that's a convenient way to plot it. Here are the well-determined values of g prime and g, and the error bars here is the current determination of the strong interaction coupling constant. As you push them to very small distances, it turns out they come together to a certain extent at values of, of order 10 to the 15th or 10 to the 16 GeV, very close actually to the Planck or string scale, which would be up here somewhere. Oh, and if you now soup this up just a little, so that you include the superpartners that are predicted in supersymmetry, the diagram actually looks extremely suggestive, as if it points to some kind of truly unified theory of all of the interactions at an energy of about 2 times 10 to the 16 GeV. So all of these, of course, are just suggestions. We have really no idea experimentally about what is really going to happen when we get into the physics of what is the mechanism of the spontaneous symmetry breaking in the weak interactions. But all these suggestions, I think, are very suggestive. In any case, we have a dramatic success for the verification of our theory of the weak interactions, and a verification that we have the experimental tools to go further. When we'll get to these high energies, we'll really find it out. So thank you very much.
Explanation for the three sigma deviation?
Oh. Actually, this is a big mystery. Let me put the slide back and we can talk a little about it. You know, it's funny. Your eye is drawn to the measurement that has the highest discrepancy. And maybe it's worth pointing out that two of the numbers here with the highest discrepancy, namely this one against these two, these three numbers theoretically should measure the same quantity or very similar quantities. And they are three of the very most accurate measurements on this table. So one guess that you might make is that all of the people who did these measurements, which, as I say, directly compete with one another, are being just a little too aggressive in the way they quote their errors. And that could well be the explanation. But if you say it's physics, then here's what the explanation is. I guess for this, I'd better get this out of the way. I need some light here. Now, and let's put this back on. So these two measurements have to do with the measurement of A sub L, the lepton asymmetry, in leptonic processes. So for example, tau decay, or the left and right-handed cross sections for making Z's. The number here is the determination of A sub L from the formula, the forward-backward asymmetry for bottom quarks coming out of the Z is 3/4 of A sub L times A sub B. And I've told you that A sub B is 0.94. The other thing that I should have told you is that A sub B is extremely insensitive to radiative corrections. You can make specific models if you know that that's what you want to do, which shift AB by a little. But the typical models that you would make have very little effect on the value of A sub B. And so you would think then that the measurement of this quantity would be a good way of extracting A sub L. And in fact, these two measurements of A sub L are discrepant by about 3 sigma. So if you assign that to the fact that A sub B differs from what the theory says, then that requires exotic interactions of the right-handed bottom quark. And you can always make a model to do that, but I don't know of any beautiful models like that. I mean, they're always models that you've really just made up for this particular occasion. What I consider much more likely is that the sample of bottom quarks used to make this measurement is impure. And if that sample is contaminated with charm quarks, you can get a lower value of this, which would then cure the discrepancy. However, last week I gave this talk at UC Riverside, which is the current home of Bob Clare, one of the strong people on the LEP Electroweak Working Group. And when I said this there, he then had a whole list of arguments about why that couldn't be true. And so, you know, what can I say? This is a point which has been debated at Slack, I would say, for more than 50 hours of my life in the last couple of years, quite inconclusively. Well, there's a student in the front row who wants to ask a question.
I was just wondering if the atomic helium precision measurements have played an important role in, for example, the
Originally they did, but today they are not so important. Let me just show this slide. So this band here, the one labeled A, which goes from here to here, is the 1990 value of the cesium experiment, atomic parity violation in atomic physics. Since then, this band has shrunk by a factor of 4, and it's also unfortunately moved out of the region preferred by the other experiments. Yeah. So what that is quite mysterious. One thing, of course, that it could be is just that the precision atomic calculation, you need to do an atomic physics calculation to sub 1% accuracy to interpret these experiments. And the way you do it is by using, basically, you say the core of cesium is inert. So to first approximation, it's just hydrogen. And then you try and compute the corrections. And the corrections are at the sort of 5% level. So if you haven't done those correctly, that could explain the discrepancy. Another explanation of the discrepancy, which is more interesting, is a new heavy Z boson, which actually doesn't come into these experiments except the cesium. So we'll see. Oh, man. Well, you know, that's a whole other subject. And I should say that I have a prejudice on this question, because the New York Times article came out the weekend of the ITP advisory board meeting. And David Gross, that weekend, was telling everyone, well, it's only a 2.5 sigma effect, but this 2.5 sigma effect is much more likely to be correct than any other 2.5 sigma effect that we've seen. So I just had to take him up on that. And so we have a bet on this. It's only $10, but there's a lot of pride involved. However, last Friday, we had a very interesting talk from a fellow named Kirill Melnikov, who's a postdoc at SLAC. Melnikov, do I have a piece of, yeah, here's the piece of chalk. Melnikov is an expert on precision QED, and in fact, he's the fellow I was talking about before the lecture who recently completed the three-loop calculation of the Lamb shift. And what he said was that he was very suspicious of the way that the following diagram was evaluated. So this is the diagram where the muon comes in, it radiates a photon. The photon goes then into strongly interacting particles and comes out. And in order to interpret the muon G minus 2 experiment, you have to measure this correction to better than 1% accuracy. Now, how do you do that? Well, there's a rigorous way to do that, which is to relate this vacuum polarization amplitude to the process where E plus E minus produces hadrons. However, unfortunately, this cross-section is not at this moment known well enough to be able to interpret the muon G minus 2 experiment with the error claimed by the experimentalists. There is actually new data from Novosibirsk, which is in the can, but it hasn't been completely analyzed. And it's not included in the Brookhaven result. So the way this is determined is that you look at tau decay, the tau going to a neutrino, producing the most important contribution is where the tau decays to a rho meson, which then decays to a pair of pions. So because there's a huge sample of tau decays from LEP, one then gets a very high statistics determination of the shape of the rho in tau decays. And then using isospin symmetry, you can convert that into the rho contribution to this diagram. That has to be done at the 1% level. And Melnikov's point was that isospin is violated at the 1% level. And so you might not expect to get the right answer if you do that naively. And he had some arguments which now just need to be pursued about whether or not that error estimate is unambiguous. If you throw away the tau decays and you only include the determinations from E plus E minus, there's actually no discrepancy. The error gets about a factor of two bigger. And if you throw away the determinations of this graph that come from tau decays, and you only keep the determinations that come from E plus E minus to hadrons data, the error on the hadronic corrections increases by about a factor of two, and the discrepancy becomes 1.5 sigma or something like that. There's also not only an increase in the error, but there's also a shift.
Is rho supposed to dominate?
Sorry?
Is rho supposed to dominate that diagram to the accuracy? How does known rho contribution tell you the answer to that?
Well, roughly, what comes in here is the integral ds over s of the cross-section for E plus E minus to hadrons. So for the smaller s is, the larger the contribution. And so the rho is actually the dominant contribution. And so you have to know the rho to 1%. When you get to 2 GeV, you have to know the cross-section to about 10%, and so on. Okay. And so every energy region, of course, comes in. But then the question is where you get the values. Well, what the Brookhaven group did was that they used an analysis of Davier and Hawker, which is very strongly reliant on the tau data. And it actually uses QCD above 1.8 GeV. And then below 1.8 GeV, you use the tau data. And then you try to essentially modify that for other effects like isospin zero that would be in E plus E minus and are not in tau. And you could say they did an honest job with it, but the question of how you evaluate the isospin violating contributions and also certain radiative corrections, which are different between tau and E plus E minus, it's not clear that it's right and it needs to be done better. Okay, so that's where I stand on that.
Other questions?